Welcome to our final panel this evening, which is a roundtable discussion with the title "The Insider's View of the Fisher Controversy." I'm probably one of the few people in the room who is not a Zeitzeuge, and I started studying in Berlin in the early 70s. The discussion was still very rife, but I never met Fritz Fischer in person. So, anyway, we have a very illustrious panel of people who were involved in many ways in the debate. Now, there's no need to introduce Hartmut Porge von Strandmann as one of Fritz Fischer's pupils, as we say in German, and academic, and Helmut Blei on my right, who worked with Egmont Zechlin, more or less door-to-door to Fritz Fischer, and in controversy, of course, and he will have a lot to tell, I'm sure, about how Zechlin's position was formed and who wrote the things. And then over there, Ben Sösemann, he will come over here in a minute, who is famous as the editor or the critique of the edition of the Ritzler Tagebücher, which played a major role then, particularly in the 70s. And we have Gerd Krummeich, who is then almost basically a generation almost later than... And
not later
no,
than...
No, but in the... not involved in the sense directly, but indirectly profiting from Fischer's work and taking it on as one of the foremost historians of the First World War in Germany these days. So, and he will tell us a lot about the impact on subsequent research. We have, unfortunately, not present among us, Emanuel Geis, who wanted to come to join this panel this evening, but he is not well enough. So, but he has sent us a paper, which will be read by John Röhl, and we have also a very short message from John Moses from Australia, another sort of participant in the debate. So what we wanted to do is have very brief sort of statements, a first round of statements on the panel, very briefly about the sort of personal involvement, the Zeitzeugen, the first Zeitzeugen round, and I want to restrict that really to a very few minutes each, and I will interrupt after 8 minutes rudely. And to go into a second round where we look a bit more about what is the general background of the debate, and then also the consequences, what did the debate bring for the profession, basically. So we start with Hartmut Porge von Strandmann.
Yes. I came to Hamburg in 1960, and I had asked Herzfeld in Berlin that I wanted to move to Hamburg, and to which historian or to should I go? And I didn't know any of them. And Herzfeld said, there's an older one called Zechlin, my generation, he writes overseas history. And there's a younger one with whom I have a dispute. So I went for the one with the dispute, but kept the door open and went to one seminar of Zechlin's as well. Anyhow, at the beginning, I didn't realize what the debate was going to become at all. It virtually exploded on me, because in Hamburg there was, at that time, a trench warfare between Zechlin camp and the Fischer camp. There were scenes you would find very perturbing indeed, in which the two were shouting at each other from their rooms, from their desks, because they were competitors in a similar field and for the same sources. It was very difficult for a young student to know what you ought to do, you know. Whether you ought to intervene and say ratio is more important or whatever, you know. But anyhow, it was a little bit intimidating. But from that, quite a good relationship with Fisher then developed. And I got involved very much in with Fisher in 1962. It was he who sent me to Oxford to apply for this scholarship to St. Anthony's. But I had to work for him a little bit before I went and left. There has been quite a severe criticism of his first chapter by a number of economic experts and economic historians. So he asked me that he wanted to do the next edition, and could I get all the mistakes eradicated and check that? And I was sort of a young student and felt sort of quite honored, thought this is a good thing to do. But it took me several days, and I discovered from Fisher at that time that Boehme had mostly written that chapter. And the mistakes I eradicated, but had to make doubly and trebly sure. I even interviewed Dahrendorf about certain facts, so that I was, the copy which went into the next edition was absolutely safe. So then, when I went to England, I wanted Fisher to come to Oxford. And I got him invited to St. Anthony's in the autumn of 1963. And it was very interesting when Fisher came. He sang Wacht am Rhein to me in the St. Anthony's Library to tell me what the atmosphere in Germany in 1914 was like, which he remembered as a small child, because he was born in 1908. But I couldn't quite follow this. This was after 1 o'clock in the morning. But anyhow, the next day I had to start on his paper, but only at the beginning, because he found it difficult to cue himself into the English languages. So we worked for a few hours on his paper, but then he withdrew and wrote the rest up. In the meeting, in the seminar meeting, it was very interesting, particularly the second day where he gave second paper, he talked about Stresemann and the nationalist right. There was a woman there called Agnes Hedler Morley, who was the first holder of the chair in international history or international relations. She walked out. Fisher said, "Why do you walk out? You offended Stresemann." And he said, "But it's all in the documents." A typical Fisher reply, you know, as this matter. But she left. She never went to any of Fisher's lectures again. The next time I saw him was in Berlin at the Berlin Historical Congress. I came from Potsdam, the archives, and Fisher, you know, this whole atmosphere was absolutely amazing. About 2,000 people for 5 hours, not one moving. And the debate was really quite something. Fisher's 10 theses were quite interesting. Particularly, they were highlighted by Fritz Stern's introduction of the element of fear and for German motivation, which I found very interesting. But I overheard Ritter saying, "Why do we have this American here? These uncultured people can't contribute anything to German history." For Fritz Stern, I found that really quite amazing. And at the end, the whole room emptied, big auditorium maximum, everyone went and talked further on. And I waited for Fisher and Margaret Fisher with me and some other Fisher's assistants. And Fisher sat with his mistress alone in the auditorium. And we couldn't wait anymore. They were all most embarrassed. And so I had to go to him and say, "Would you not like to come to dinner with us? Otherwise you have to do it on your own." So he leapt to his feet and came with us. But it was interesting, you know, as a student suddenly to become aware that he had a mistress as well. Then the big meeting in Vienna was, of course, very interesting indeed. A lot of people, that was when I first met Fritz Klein, and we talked with Fritz Klein about the war, etc. But the interesting thing was, and that's a little anecdote, that Didier, the Serbian historian, came up to me, and he was so excited by the atmosphere, he said, "Do you know what has happened? The German general staff has organized the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand." Wishful thinking. He didn't. But it's interesting just to show what the atmosphere was like. And that is very interesting final note, really. When I came back from 63 visits in Germany, I was constantly invited, even as a student, to meeting of teachers, to meeting of students, to talk about the First World War and the Fisher thesis. And it is such an interesting atmosphere if you compare that with any later debate, which may have been popular, but this was really going much further, and we need a research subject on the local papers, which are full of Fisher books and reviews and views and letters as well. And that would be quite an interesting subject, because it wasn't only the Zunft or the intelligent journalists. It took much wider circles and became really quite a popular debate, at least until the end of 64. So I don't want to step...
Wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. Then we move straight over to Helmut Bly.
This is
next door, so to speak.
Yes, this is quite another story, and it's interesting how a student reacted on the situation. My perception is that we as colleague, as assistants to Böhme, to Emanuel Geis, who is really seriously ill, and I'm very sad about this, we had good relation all the time. And in the long run, to say it, now already Fischer and Zechlin became friends when they became very old. And Fischer supported my application to the chair in Hanover when I asked him, because I was writing the stuff Zechlin was signing as author. So I didn't took him so serious. But now to the controversy. It started with an absolutely accident. He had been asked by the Duchess from Mecklenburg to assist her against the claims of a Polish lady that she was Anastasia of the Romanovs, who survived the massacre of Ekaterinburg. We now have the DNA of Anastasia, so she really was not this lady. The stake was the perceived fortunes of the Romanovs in the Bank of England. My job was to find out if she knew something which was not published in the exil literature. So I have read all this stuff, even the Russian one, to help with others. The only claim I found was that she said the Duke of Hessen-Darmstadt, who was president of the German Red Cross at that time, had been in Russia in 1916. It was easy to prove that he was not there because the Archduke cannot disappear. But Zechlin, as a good journalist, war journalist of the First World War, and he was driving on the lorry with Rosa Luxemburg during the January 1919 things in Berlin, said, "There is smoke, there must be fire, and this fire is a separate peace. This Russia, between the Germans and Russia, there are attempts." So we entered the war of research from a late period in this sense that we started, and I think there Zechlin has his merits that he took that point, from November 1914, after the war was lost at the Marne and the stalemate was there, and the German military, what they always used successfully in 1919, to get rid of the responsibility for losing a war and pushed him towards peace. And he said, no, don't go into this trap. You first win the war in Russia, and then we try a separate peace. So when Fischer came out with the, or Emanuel Geis rediscovered the September program, Herzfeld had already seen it in 1940, but was quiet about it. We reacted from the position of a disillusion about the war. And this was one step. Then I went into the origins of the First World War because of Fischer's first chapter, and we came to very different conclusions in the sense that I realized in the archives that the British government had talked to the Russian government to deploy British warship at the Baltic Sea in order to attack the Pomeran borderline. And Bethmann Hollweg, and there was a German spy in the British embassy, and so they knew. And Bethmann asked Gray, and he denied. And from that moment, he knew there will be no neutrality of Great Britain. Fischer was shocked. But as I talked to Berghahn and others, they had their route is that they said, yes, but after 6 weeks, after the conquest of Paris. But the whole thing in Fischer's mind was they took even more risk. They were really lunatics in the sense when he heard about this. Now to the war aims and our view on it. Because of this late illusion, and because of Great Britain going to, into the war, we read the September program and the program of trying to revitalize the Baltic states and Russia, Ukraine, and parts of the British Empire as a sign of despair that they had were confronted with a war situation where they knew, and America was behind this as well, they were aware of the, what could happen, that this was a case of despair, and so we didn't took them too serious. When I did research about later about August Bebel's discussion with the British government between 1907 and 1913, where he warned the British government about German aggressive tendencies, it was used by Churchill and others to hit the British Liberal Party and force them with this picture of German aggressivism to go into the war. And I conclude from this, and it would be interesting to discuss this here in London, that from that point on, only the fact that Germany went to war was the key point, perhaps connected a bit with the Belgian dimension that the Germans were not ready, even the Social Democrats were not ready to get make Belgium free. Bebel knew since 1913 that Belgium would be attacked. He knew it from the Budget Commission in the Reichstag. So I believe that the hegemonic impulse of the Germans were understood at least by the British, and that the full war aim debate is in a sense futile. They wanted to get rid of the militarist structures. And I think that even the German party like Erzberger and others understood this. And this goes to the decline of the Kaiser. I have to stop, but I have to... Yes, well, our key argument, strongly influenced by you, was we saw the Germans not expansive in the sense of Fischer's Griff nach der Weltmacht, but as the idea we have to be able to be successfully militarily against all big powers in Germany, otherwise we lose control and can't expand, and they... understood this as radical defense concept, but never reflected that the other sides regarded this, of course, as an aggression. And from this point, I think me more than Zechlin narrowed to Fischer's position without being in details on agreeing on the war aims, on the Middle European question, and so on. So I just stop at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed. John, would you like to insert at that point?
One sentence I forgot because I talked about the friendship. I learned now from the Hamburg University that Zechlin and others in the department tried to force Fischer to leave the chair for current history. And they called somebody else, I forgot the name at the moment. Unfortunately, this man declined the call, so Fischer continued. I had no idea about this type of intrigue that Zechlin was involved, and I was really stunned and troubled by this when I heard it.
Do you want to add Emanuel Geis's message?
As Andreas Gestrich said, Emanuel Geis wanted very much to be here. He was the man who was at Fischer's side at the writing of Griff nach der Weltmacht more than anybody else. And he's provided me with a statement which I've translated into English, and he has approved what I'm about to say. So it is very much his voice that you're hearing and not mine. This is not my version of what happened. This is what he said. I got to know Fritz Fischer in the autumn of 1957 in the Deutsches Zentralarchiv in Potsdam, when he arrived to undertake archival research on the files of the Reichskanzlei for his project on German war aims in the First World War. I had been working in the archives in Potsdam and Merseburg since 1956, and as a then second-year student, assistant to the American professor Stefan Possoni and his study of the Lenin mission. I therefore knew the archive very well already when Fischer arrived. I ordered the Reichskanzlei file with the key document, Bethmann-Hollweg's September program of 1914, and handed it to him, who was sitting in a row behind, in the row behind me, with the words, "Sehen Sie mal hier, Professor, Herr Professor." That was the beginning of our working relationship. Out of our sojourn in the archives of the GDR, there developed the suggestion that I should move from Munich, where I was studying under Franz Schnabel, to Hamburg in order to write my doctoral dissertation on the Polish border strip under Fritz Fischer. In the summer of 1958, he asked me to help him with his book on Germany's war aims, and I readily agreed. By that time, Fischer had already collected the archival material from Potsdam and from the political archive of the Auswärtiges Amt in Bonn. As the rivalry between Fischer and his Hamburg colleague Egmont Zechlin grew ever more bitter, I suggested to him in the spring of 1959 that it would be prudent for him to stake his claim to his topic with a preliminary article in the Historische Zeitschrift. Fischer took up my idea with enthusiasm and again asked me to help him with that, and he goes on to say with the second article, the reply to Hans Herzfeld in the Historische Zeitschrift as well. Work on the manuscript of Griff nach der Weltmacht began on the 9th of September 1959, 45 years to the day after the September program and the Battle of the Marne. In contrast to the two articles for the Historische Zeitschrift, on which Fischer and I had worked alone, we were now joined in his office by Frau Lili Leverenz. Fischer stood in his corner at the windowsill. I sat at his desk with my old Remington typewriter, with Frau Leverenz sitting behind me, with the documents arranged on a low table in front of her. She was in charge of the documents, selecting the one that was to be dealt with next. In this respect, later criticism was fully justified that Fischer was in effect skipping from one document to the other. When the first draft of some 400 double-spaced pages was finished in spring 1960, I said to him, "Now we need a chapter on the July crisis of 1914. Again, he agreed immediately, and I set about studying the literature and the published documents, and this issue came up earlier, of course. Since I was now suffering from repetitive strain injury, brought on by typing the first draft, Fischer typed the text of this chapter on his own typewriter to my dictation while I was balancing Albertini and the official document publications on my knees. On handing him the second draft, now expanded to some 600 pages, I stressed to Fischer that the conclusion on German continuities was provisional only, that he would need to refine the text and draw out the implications of the entire book. I was shocked when the volume appeared in print with the last paragraph on Stresemann and continuity unchanged, hanging, as it were, in the air. Sometime in 1960, Fischer returned to Hamburg, having had discussions with the Droste Verlag in Düsseldorf, and in search of a suitably attractive title. I immediately proposed Deutschlands Griff nach der Weltmachtstellung with an appropriate subtitle. It was the publisher who cut this nuanced title down to the more sensational Griff nach der Weltmacht. As I was leaving Hamburg in the autumn of 1960 for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, I suggested that Fischer should cut some 60 pages, that is to say about 10%, from the second draft before the book went into print. Instead, when the book appeared in the following year, it had been inflated by about one-third, including a new introductory chapter on Germany's pre-war Weltpolitik written by Helmut Böhme, who was 7 years younger and even less experienced than me. I did not play any part in the writing of Fischer's later books, but rather regretted the subsequent radicalization of our original more moderate position, which I can explain only in terms of the growing radicalism of the younger generation of helpers as 1968 approached." That's it.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Gerd Grohmeich just said that he would sort of follow from there. Is that all right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Let me continue with these personal recollections. which will lead us certainly to the structural questions which we are asked to discuss. I am not a Fischerian. I'm a pupil in the German sense of Wolfgang Mommsen, one of his first students and assistants in Düsseldorf University. But I met Fritz Fischer much before I met Wolfgang Mommsen. And that comes so. I was 15 years old and is in grammar school in Düsseldorf when our teacher, Ernst Hoffmann, Stick, told us, you were not there, told us that every intelligent being must go to the popular university this evening because the most famous Fritz Fischer would be speaking, and that he would only take pupils serious who would go there to listen to this revolutionary discourse. And I went there, as everybody had to go there. And Fritz Fischer spoke us about German war aims. I had 15 years, and I never heard about this. And then he said, there were 200 or 300 people, always 200, 300, 400 people when Fischer did a conference. And then he said, well, between the war aims of the Alldeutsch and Bethmann-Hollweg war aims, they are just nuance. They are only nuance. And me? I pointed up, as I do, naturally, and I asked him in this discussion that I didn't really understand, because we have just learned that Albert Camus has said that the truth is in the nuance. That was my first meeting with Fritz Fischer. A couple of years ago, afterwards, I was a student to Göttingen University, listening to Schramm, Heimpel, and all these other. Oh, we went to Hamburg once, because it was necessary to go to Hamburg in 1964, 1965. Every intelligent people, pre-revolutionarian, had to go to Hamburg to listen once, at least, to Fritz Fischer. So I went to Hamburg with some course students, and there were again 300, 400 people listening to him, and then by discussion, I put a question, because I put all these questions. And Fischer said, are you not this guy who has been so disrespected with me? This was our second in public. Disrespected. And Wolfgang Mommsen was very pleased with this afterwards. And the next thing was that Wolfgang Mommsen said to me, well, when I searched a theme for my doctoral dissertation, and I spoke French, I had lived in France, and he said, well, you could draw on the war preparation of France, because Fritz Fischer does not really consider those. And there's no archival research up to now. And so I did. Why not? And when my doctoral thesis was finished in 1980, I sent a copy to Fritz Fischer, because I had a lot contradicted him, and I was so proud. And then I received a letter, 8 pages long letter, which I have here. And I will read you some, not the whole letter, but just half a page of it, which has been translated by Alan Kramer. Thank you, Alan. Fischer writes me, it seems to me that you have placed the modalities, the how of the defense of the French, far above the basic problem, the why. For there can be no doubt that ever since Germany's blackmail-type maneuver, threatening war in the Agadir crisis, France, just like Britain and Russia, was living under the fear of German attack, which would be launched with full strength against the West. This fear was reawakened in early 1913, the armaments question. Equally, there is no doubt that France did not want to be outpaced by rearmament. The defensive character of this strategy of the French people has never been denied. In other words, in response to the German attack, which was widely expected and for which there was not much evidence, since the consecutive order of the German plan had been recognized and was known. First France, then Russia. Since the French army had to renounce an offensive in Belgium, the General Staff therefore planned offensives north of Metz and south of Metz in Lorraine and so on. How should the government and the General Staff have notified Parliament and the public about these military plans as a rationale for the 3-year conscription law, as you implicitly demand? That would have been suicidal. They also could not explain to Parliament that France could only hope to survive the German assault if France, through its own action, secured the simultaneous action it desired. That means the Russian offensive according to their agreements. This was not a matter of concealment in the sense of an immoral act. In order to obtain majorities in Parliament, political rationale and tactics made it necessary to argue for the law on the basis of military strategy considerations pointing to the German peril and also to the Republican idea of national defense. That was, I wrote him a letter, which I will not quote now, that he was not right. This was 1981. And we were not really friends. But I had understood one thing then, which had driven me to Hamburg when I was student to Göttingen and afterwards to Cologne, that really Fischer put the stress and the strength on one argument which has never been said. Today, Hartmut, you have said it. He was really important for the pre-revolutionary movement of the German students. In a way, because when, and this is a thing I think established in my article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which I will not read either here, from November 1999, it was the 40 years of the first article of Fischer. When I said that this man and his thesis on the Wilhelmine Germany did really interest us students because they were in alignment with what we then had heard and learned newly about Auschwitz and the Auschwitz process and on the continuity of German history. And there had been nobody else before to tell us this. So I wrote this article against my intimate friend Fritz Fischer, for my intimate friend Fritz Fischer, to thank him for what he had done.
Thank you very much, Gerd Kummer.
Then finally.
Ja, wenn ich jetzt langsam spreche, versteht mich jeder, ne? Wahrscheinlich.
Ja, yeah, I can summarize perhaps
yeah? afterwards. Yeah. Ah, ja, yeah. Gut. Ja, bei mir ist.
Is there anyone, should I summarize it afterwards or do you all, is it sufficient?
Ich werde langsam sprechen.
Yeah.
Aber es ist besser, wenn ich Deutsch spreche. Ich habe zu viel Ehrfurcht vor Ihrer schönen Sprache, weil ich mal Anglistik studieren wollte, Shakespeares wegen. Und dann habe ich es gelassen, weil ich so viel Linguistik auch machen musste. Bei mir ist es alles etwas anders. Im Ansatz wie bei Gerd. Ich bin auch kein Fischer-Schüler. Aber ich habe John Röhl kennengelernt. Wo? Im Archiv. Wo? Mit ihm gesprochen? Auf der Bank vor dem Archiv beim Butterbrot. Denn essen gingen wir nicht, das kostete zu viel Zeit. Und im Archiv konnten wir auch nicht miteinander reden, denn bei ihm rieselte immer der Sand aus den Akten und er freute sich, dass er der Erste war, der sie aufgeschnürt hatte. Während ich mich darüber freute, dass ich auf dem Frontblatt nach Ranke und Dreußen und Treitschke dann so der Dritte oder Vierte war, der sich mit den preußischen Reformen dann beschäftigt hatte. Zu Fritz Fischer bin ich gekommen, wie die Jungfrau zum Kind oder, müsste man sagen, wie die Jungfrau zum Tagebuch. Denn ich edierte die Tagebücher Theodor Wolffs aus dem Ersten Weltkrieg und wunderte mich. Und dieses Wundern dauerte 8 Jahre. Dann war es zu Ende, denn dann hatte ich die Rietzler-Originale in der Hand und dann änderte sich das in Minuten. Erstens, wie kann ein Tagebuch in einer dramatischen Situation so geschrieben sein, dass zwei Kontrahenten, Erdmann und Fritz Fischer, sich auf ein und denselben Text beziehen und sagen, dieser Text stützt meine Ansicht. Den wollte ich gern lesen, diesen Text. Diesen Text konnte ich nicht lesen und meine Verwunderung gegenüber dem Bundesarchiv, wenn ein Text komplett ediert ist, ist er doch frei. Nein, hieß es, er ist gesperrt. Dann habe ich 6 Jahre lang meine Bitten immer wiederholt und nach dem 4. Jahr gab es die Ermunterung aus dem Archiv mit dem Satz, ja, meine Fragen seien interessant. Dann blieb ich dran. Angeblich hat die Tochter Rietzlers, die Nichte, den Nachlass gesperrt. Ich bat dann das Archiv, sie für tot erklären zu lassen in den USA. Und innerhalb weniger Monate war sie ganz munter und wunderte sich, dass ich mich wunderte, denn der Nachlass sei frei. Es gibt Vermutungen, wer ihn hat sperren lassen. Und dann sah ich dieses Blatt. Und das braucht man auch nur mal einen Proseminaristen, einen Anfänger zu zeigen. Dann ist das Blatt voller Geheimnisse. Und dies ist die erste Originalseite des Tagebuchs aus dem Juli 1914. Die erste Seite. Da hat jemand eine Eintragung gestrichen, die Daten verändert und Text dazu geschrieben. Jetzt könnten wir die zweispaltig. Ich habe Ihnen den Text transkribiert, an den Rand geschrieben, damit Sie sehen, wovon ich rede. Der Inhalt ist nicht aufregend und auch nicht besonders wichtig für meine Argumentation. Wichtig ist nur, dass Erdmann sich bemüßigt fühlte, dieses Chaos, diese Bearbeitungen, diese Veränderungen in seiner Edition mit einem Schleier zu überziehen, sodass der Leser keine Chance hat zu sehen, dass das, was Herr Erdmann tut, die dritte Bearbeitung, Überarbeitung oder Verfälschung eines historischen Dokuments darstellt. Der erste, der am Rietzler Tagebuch geradezu gewütet hat, ist der berühmte Kunsthistoriker und Bruder Walter Rietzler. Der hat nämlich kurzerhand erklärt, dass die Tagebuchaufzeichnungen aus der Zeit, die wir für besonders interessant halten, nämlich vor dem 1914, also aus dem Jahre 10, 11, 12, 13, in denen die Kriegsgefahr für die Zeitgenossen extrem hoch war, diese Aufzeichnungen bis auf einen kleinen Rest alle zu vernichten, mit dem Argument, das sei für Historiker überhaupt nicht interessant. Der zweite, der darin arbeitete, war Kurt Rietzler selbst. Und der kann ja sein Tagebuch schlecht verfälschen. Man muss da wohl sagen, er hat es verändert. Wie hat er das getan? Er hat seine Originale aus der Zeit benutzt als Grundlage für einen reichlich, ich pointiere jetzt, fantasierten neuen Text. Ich kann nichts darüber sagen. Wie er es gemacht hat, kann ich sagen. Aber ich kann nichts über den Inhalt sagen. Ich hätte Ihnen am liebsten diese Blätter mitgebracht, die nämlich aus diesem ersten kleinen Tagebuch herausgerissen sind. Man weiß, dass da Blätter waren, weil man die Rissspuren sieht. Und dieses Originaltagebuch ist so klein, so ein kleines Vokabelheft. Davor liegen aber die von Kurt Rietzler aufgrund der nicht mehr vorhandenen Originale komponierten neuen Tagebuchaufzeichnungen auf viel größeren, nämlich fast DIN A4 großen Blättern, gleichmäßig beschrieben, von links unten nach rechts oben etwas laufen, wunderbar genau korrigiert, wenn er sich verschrieben hatte. Also eindeutig ein Schreibtischprodukt der Ruhe, später geschrieben. Das Tagebuch selbst sieht eher so aus, wie Sie es hier sehen. Und das brachte mich dazu, mich darum zu kümmern. Und jetzt sage ich Ihnen, was Sie da nicht lesen können, was ich auch nicht lesen konnte, ist, was da so dick durchgestrichen ist. Das sollte auch keiner lesen, denn das ist das stärkste Indiz für die Überarbeitung. Rietzler hatte da geschrieben im Originaltagebuch, es steht ja daneben, die Zwischenzeit, nicht eine Minute für eine Notiz, kaum möglich nachträglich irgendetwas über die Zeit zu sagen. Ein, wenn Sie wollen, nichtssagender Satz, oder Sie können auch sagen, eine philosophische Bemerkung. Ich konnte sie nur deshalb lesen, weil diese relativ nichtssagende Bemerkung auf den komponierten 19 Blättern vorkommt. Das heißt, er hat da zusammengeleimt, geschrieben und das schon verwendet und dann bemerkt, da steht es ja nochmal, das muss weg. Aber er konnte das nicht rausreißen, dann fehlte diese Seite. Deshalb hat er es durchgestrichen. Und die letzten Seiten konnte er auch nicht rausziehen. Ja, ich habe, glaube ich, nur noch eine Minute, Sie sind sehr gnädig. Also, als ich damit zu dem Archivar kam, sagte er, Sie haben eine blühende Fantasie. Und dann, nachdem ich Ihnen das erklärt habe, bekam er genauso kalte Füße wie ich, weil er dann sagte, sagen Sie mal, Sie haben mir gerade erzählt, dass Ihre Edition der Theodor-Wolff-Tagebücher von der Historischen Kommission bei der Bayerischen Akademie der Wissenschaften zur Publikation angenommen worden ist, weil Herr Erdmann ein fulminantes, positives Gutachten geschrieben hat. Wie wollen Sie ihm denn das klar machen, was er hier für eine Edition abgeliefert hat? Das war mein persönliches Problem. Ich habe es ihm vorab geschrieben. Da brach er jeglichen Kontakt mit mir ab. Ich lernte Fritz Fischer kennen. Fritz Fischer freute sich über meine Studien. Ich musste ihm sagen, Sie sind genauso wenig textkritisch herangegangen. Dann hat er gesagt, ja, darüber müssen wir mal reden. Das haben wir getan. 45 Minuten über sein Leben bei laufender Filmkamera für das Institut für den wissenschaftlichen Film in Göttingen. Und dann war seine Frau saß daneben und es war fantastisch, wie sie ihn permanent korrigierte und wir und die Kamera alles erfuhren. Und dann haben wir das am Nachmittag mit 45 Minuten über sein wissenschaftliches Werk fortgesetzt. Und der Regisseur sagte, also wissen wir, wir schneiden keinen Satz. Das war großartig, wie Herr Fischer eins aus dem anderen heraus entwickelt hat. Ja, das heißt, meine ganze Biografie ist mit Tagebüchern, dadurch mit John Röhl und Fritz Fischer verbunden und ich freue mich natürlich besonders, dass ich heute da bin. Jetzt bin ich emeritiert und rede nochmal über den Rietzler.
Ja, herzlichen Dank. Und wir haben noch ganz kurz, um diese erste Runde abzuschließen, glaube ich, auch nur 5 Minuten, 6 Minuten Botschaft von.
If you arrived in Munich early in 1961, to continue your study of modern history already begun in Brisbane, you could not avoid noticing the excited discussion about the emerging Fischer controversy. Griff nach der Weltmacht was being reviewed, for example, in the Süddeutsche Zeitung. But as far as I recall, my professor Franz Schnabel, in whose Hauptseminar I had enrolled, did not directly enter the debate. I had purchased his Deutsche Geschichte im 19. Jahrhundert and was aware, therefore, of the Roman Catholic liberals' deep-seated antipathy towards Prussianism and militarism. I also soon purchased Griff nach der Weltmacht and had frequent discussions about it with my German fellow students. I made the point that what Fischer was saying about the Prussian-German power elite, their war aims, and the behaviour of the Prussian-German army was already well known in Australia through the 11-volume official history of the war, edited by Charles Bean. As Professor Ernest Scott of Melbourne wrote in volume 11, the Great War was Australia's pivotal historical experience. It had been the consequence of German militarism, the heralds of which were the likes of Heinrich von Treitschke and Friedrich von Bernhardi. Remember, Australia and New Zealand were also objects of German expansionist aims in the Pacific, and Graf von Spee's operational plans for the East Asia Squadron were rightly assessed by the Australian government. That is chiefly why Australia acquired her own fleet unit prior to the war. In a word, as an Australian history student, I was already aware of the thrust of Griff nach der Weltmacht. Fisher's findings were a confirmation of what we had already believed to be in the case. After four semesters with Franz Schnabel, I moved to Erlangen in order to do a doctorate with Waldemar Besson on German trade union history. My obligatory subsidiary subjects included modern German history with Walter Peter Fuchs, and it is to Fuchs that I am indebted for an abiding interest in German historiography through his Haupt seminar back in 1964 entitled Widerstand gegen die Obrigkeit. Fuchs was a Reformation historian and was clearly massively impressed by Fischer's famous address at the 1949 Munich Historians Conference, Der Deutsche Protestantismus und die Politik im 19. Jahrhundert, which had so aroused the ire of Professor Gerhard Ritter. Fischer had mounted a frontal attack on Prussian-German political culture, contrasting it with the liberal parliamentary political culture that had taken root in the West as a consequence of the Reformation. In Prussia, on the other hand, the legacy of the Reformation was to reaffirm monarchical absolutism, a system in which the highest virtue was obedience to the powers that be, whereas in the West, the culture developed in which the right to resistance to authority became the acknowledged political norm. Consequently, in the summer semester of 1964, Fuchs introduced the seminar on Widerstand gegen die Obrigkeit, which began first with an investigation of Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms, which by the 19th century required unquestioning obedience from all sections of society to the powers that be. Fuchs began by saying that the culture of unquestioning obedience to the state and its agencies had been disastrous for Germany, and that it should finally be overcome and replaced by a genuine liberal parliamentary culture. It was the role of historians in particular to see to it that students understood this from now on, since historians were, as he put it, the Volksbildhauer, moulding the political values of their pupils. Fuchs then had a student examine the political values of Jean Calvin by way of contrast. It was predominantly Calvin's ideas about the right of resistance against a monarch who demanded questionable behaviour of their subjects, such as participation in an unjust war. Having thus laid the foundations of the seminar, Fuchs proceeded to lead a chronological investigation of so-called political historians from Leopold von Ranke until Gerhard Ritter, weekly for the rest of the semester. All these men anchored the statist mentality in the political culture of Germany, of German students, all of them being strongly Lutheran by training. That educational mould had been utterly disastrous for Germany. It was high time that someone like Fritz Fischer, who had come out of that tradition, should, by virtue of new insights acquired after the war, insist on the building up of a more militant, liberal, democratically oriented historiography that would serve to align Germany more and more with the West. It was this experience that led me to reflect and write about Fischer's impact on German historiography. in the process. I had visited Fischer many times in Hamburg as his house guest and learned in the course of numerous conversations how he had become such a militant liberal.
Well, thank you very much for this first round, and I would like to take the discussion just on a bit before we open it to the public. And we have, I mean, coming from the last interview, how Fischer turned into a liberal, this goes, I think, into the history of the 1950s also. And if we follow the latest or the debates on the liberalization of the Federal Republic and Uli Herbert's work, then the 50s are quite important. And we have 59, of course, not only Fritz Fischer's article, we have Dahrendorf's important work, we have Mommsen has been quoted, Mommsen's biography, and so on. Habermas' Studentenpolitik was published in, I think, in 61, but of course written beforehand, which antagonized him with Horkheimer, above all, why he had to go to Marburg. So a bit about the atmosphere in the time, and what is the, I mean, this book and Fischer's work didn't come out of nothing. So perhaps the Dahrendorf was in Hamburg at the time. So could the Zeitzeugen say a bit about their perception? Was there any? Did you see the context of that, or was that like a Deus ex machina work? Because it always concentrates so much on that book, and I think we need to open the discussion up a bit in the broader context.
Well, the interesting thing is for Fischer. Yeah. He had 2 semesters in America, and he told me that this was more important than being prisoner of war, of changing his attitudes and meeting American professors and establishing relations with Holborn, Epstein, Craig, etc., and discussing aspects of German history. And that was really quite a revelation for him, because you could see German history from a different angle. And I think this is a deeply influential period for Fischer, these 2 semesters in Hamburg. And when he came back when he came back the second time, he started with seminars on the First World War, the origins of the First World War, and was amazed what students had found. He said, you know, my whole view changed of that period, because I'd been brought up and educated, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, and suddenly to find that young historians can challenge some of the views and show something what happened was the additional revelation he had before he started then with his research project.
I think that's quite an important point if one looks at the sort of intellectual history of the Federal Republic. The Fulbright students, the first ones, I mean, Habermas himself, others, and there were times when I think 80% of Helmut Schmidt's cabinet had spent their formative years in the United States. So this is, I'm sure, a very important aspect. But Helmut Blei, would you like to add to it?
Yes, I think the American experience of Fritz Fischer, if I recall it, was that he saw the Kaiserreich and the readiness to take risks as a warning for the United States that they were on the jump towards doing the same mistakes Germany had done. He saw this world power in danger. This was another element, perhaps not the dominant one, because he was with the German historians there, but I think this was an important point. I was too young and perhaps too naive to see big contexts. But when I got into this business with Zechlin, I wrote already my PhD to discover the first genocide of the 20th century done by the Germans with all the language, behandeln, vernachlässigen, and so on. And we were, of course, attacked in the similar way. Of course, I was regarded as a communist, and because the GDR historians who assisted us with their own material, like Drexler, we were not close, but anyhow related. So we were pushed in a corner and were stubborn enough to continue. And when I gave in 1964 a lecture in Oxford on the National Conference of the Southwest African People's Organization, the SWAPO, there was a spy from the Friedrich Ebert Foundation who told the ambassador that I was talking about destruction and I was close to the genocide. And then I got a warning from the Foreign Office over the president of the university and so on, that we should behave properly. But Zechlin was absolutely for academic freedom, and the chancellor was for academic freedom. In other circumstances, I think I would have been a lost case. And we had the Sonntagsblatt as a mouthpiece, where we defended Fritz Fischer's journey to the United States, which he appreciated, and where we answered the Foreign Office, we don't bow down. So there were different sources in a sense, but it went parallel, and Pogge was also in the colonial business already.
Well, it's difficult, but perhaps you have always sensed what I wanted to say, that is, in one sense, scientifically concerning the outbreak of the First World War, well, I'm up to now the opinion that Fischer is not sufficiently in the nuance, and that he is missing the nuance. This is one thing, and which I keep. But the other thing is, what I said in this article in 1991, and now I read you 10 lines in German. And I spoke of this event, the Fischer event, for a whole generation of students. Wir folgten Fischer vor allem, weil er die gesetzten älteren Herren zur Weißglut brachte, die seminarmäßig über die Dämonie der Macht, über deutschen Geist und deutsches Schicksal, über Bismarcks historische Größe und dergleichen mehr lehrten. In Wahrheit hatte der Streit über den Kriegsausbruch 1914 lediglich die Rolle eines Stellvertreterkrieges. Denn eigentlich hatten wir eine ganz andere Frage, die freilich nur ganz wenige zu stellen wagten. Es war die Frage nach Auschwitz und wie das hatte geschehen können. It was a problem of the continuity of German history. But the younger people here in this room perhaps do not imagine how this was a break, how this generation of historians and politicians had thought the Second World War and Hitler in terms of a discontinuity. And so we couldn't understand anything. We wanted to understand, because it was a time when there was the Auschwitz process, when there was the Eichmann trial. We wanted to understand how this had been come and brought about. And I'm still not a Fischerian, because there's no nuance. But he awakened a whole generation of students then.
But in that context, of course, you could ask, or in the light of the later debates, for Fischer, what, of course, has been asked for others. Did you ever talk about what Fischer did in the years before? I mean, it took until the 2004 and 2005 until you actually started to question, his own past. Did he ever talk about it? I mean, those...
I remember one thing. Yeah. On the night, late Arno Zivotek, we met in a commission on the Töpfer question in Hamburg, and Zivotek told me that happily these files had not yet surfaced. They surfaced very late concerning Fischer in the Nazi period.
Ja. Lieber Gerd, du hast jetzt zweimal oder dreimal angemahnt, Differenzierung Richtung Fritz. Ja, ist auch richtig. Ist auch richtig. Ja, ja, wunderbar. Ja, sehr schön. Aber ich wollte sagen, du hast etwas zu großzügig über die Debatte in der deutschen Studentenschaft gesprochen. Ich kann nur für Göttingen sagen, dass du in dem einen Punkt völlig richtig liegst. Die, für uns Studenten waren die Ursachen, Probleme, Quellenprobleme, die sich aus Fischers Position ergaben, mitunter viel zu schwierig. Aber in den Gesprächen und indem du das eben erzähltest, habe ich das wieder vor dem geistigen Auge, einen Auftritt von Fischer in Göttingen, und das Ergebnis war, dass wir in großen Gruppen zusammenstanden mit den Assistenten, mit den Professoren und das aussprachen, was du meinst, was ihr nicht ausgesprochen habt. Wir waren nämlich ganz schnell vom Ersten Weltkrieg weg, beim Zweiten Weltkrieg, bei der deutschen Geschichte, bei der Weimarer Republik, und das waren heiße Debatten. Und an dem Punkt stimme ich wieder mit dir überein, dass Fritz Fischer mit seinen Büchern und mit seinen Argumentationen und Positionen diese Auseinandersetzung angeregt hat. Und in dem Film, von dem ich gesprochen habe, habe ich versucht, so in diese Richtung zu gehen und nach seiner eigenen Vergangenheit zu fragen. Und da war die Reaktion der beiden sehr interessant, also auch wie Frau Fischer dann dazwischen ging, das kann ich jetzt nicht referieren, man muss den Film einfach mal ansehen. Den kann man übrigens ausleihen beim Institut für den wissenschaftlichen Film in Göttingen, ist gar kein Problem. Aber das ist hochinteressant, ihn zu erleben und dann in der Retrospektive.
Yes, I think I'm a bit older. Than Pogge, for instance, or Kumai, we were not so radical with our elders. We knew about the Reichsinstitut. Mm. I knew that Zechlin was the director of the Institut für Seegeldung under the umbrella of the SS. But I also knew that he was close to Gerhard Ritter, and Gerhard Ritter was close to section of the Gördler circle of the. So we were not confused, but we were tolerant in a sense. I remember when I went, I have public law as a dissertation subject, and all these law professors at Hamburg University had a fascist tradition, so where to go to? And then I went to Herbert Ibsen, was clear, it was impossible. I had seen his files. But Herbert Krüger, I went to him and said, I have written your book, you have written 1944, Einheit und Freiheit, which was a party reform for the Nationalist Socialist Party, 1944. And I asked the question, why did you survive? How did you survive this? It was a book to save NSDAP without Hitler. And then you see that a man of your generation can ask this question. I went to my military friends and they got me into the military, so the Gestapo had no chance. We were tolerant with them, and he said to me, you haven't written in a red worst things I have written done before. So if we were much more tolerant, and the debate on the Nazi involvement is the 68 students' generation's point, and we were far too tolerant to them, would I say now.
Fischer gave a lecture in America, or several times asked, when I was a member of the Nazi Party. And that I find interesting and revealing. He was asked by students and then put his views down. I've never seen that lecture in his papers, but I haven't been in Koblenz. So he gave, and I was surprised because American students wrote me and said, this is very interesting that he has done that. So I asked him about it, and he said, I must explain to you how this has developed. And this conversation then never took place. But he has given lectures in America when I was a member of the Nazi Party. So it's interesting that he admitted to that. And that was when he was in Princeton. So just.
There was also that book called Frauen, this American book on Frauen, called Frauen, the English title of it, in which Frau Fischer is the subject of the first chapter. And she speaks very frankly of her time in Nazi Germany, and as I remember it, the joy she felt throughout that time until the very end.
Okay, I mean, going from that whole question of being member of the Nazi Party and being influenced by Nazi ideology, or having been influenced by Nazi ideology, of course, in the light of the recent debates on Volksgeschichtsschreibung and so on, Fischer, if I'm right, took quite a different... I mean, he stuck to, in some sense, diplomatic, but we saw that he also opened it up. And how much do you think did he actually... Was he methodologically really innovative, or is it? What did the debate bring for us on the methodological question? And did this book have a real driving force as far as the way we look at history is concerned?
I think we were much less connected with the book. It was a group. Berghahn calls us the Hamburg group. So these were 10 or more people. And they, like Klaus Saul or Böhme or so, went into new social history and economic history dimensions like Witt and so on. And this, and I went into a reform of colonial history, which was where I connected social history of German thinking and the reality in the colony, which was very friendly received here in Great Britain, because he said, we are not so far to combine these both things. And when I traveled in the United States, I traveled at the borderline between social history and social sciences and history, and Sylvia Srap and all these people were on the same line. And I would say the influence of the Elies and of the Sylvia Sraps and of Stern and so on was very, very important for this methodological dimension. And then, of course, Ely came and others, and they broadened the view systematically. And Fischer was there was his famous book, but he didn't reflect these so in a methodological dimension so extensively. I don't know if I'm fair with this.
Well, I think that's a bit narrow. He was quite interested in new approaches to history.
That's right.
And obviously, if you look at his book, unlike what Richard said today, it's not about diplomatic history at all. It is about economic history, it's about social history and political history. That was his main interest. But he's wide enough, and that was a new departure. I found that quite appealing as a student, that he didn't just concentrate on governmental records, that he was interested in other aspects. And when I started working for my thesis and talked about colonial companies and gave two papers to a seminar, his contributions and discussions were really very good and very interesting. He was interested in the subject, and he wouldn't have been if economic history was dead for him or whatever. So on that basis, he sent me to Oxford. So it was really to continue this line of political and economic history.
Okay, I think we should open up the discussion now, and I see several people. Chris Clark has, and then Holger.
I mean, I would like to hear a little bit more about Fischer and the Nazi period, which I think we've been sort of tiptoeing around and not quite sure why, because I agree entirely with Gerhard Krummeich that what one misses when one reads Fischer is nuance. One has millions of sources, but one feels one is observing a mind at work which always knows in advance what it wants to find out. And when the sources support the view, they're simply splattered onto the page to say their piece. When they don't, they're pushed and described as euphemisms or as feints or whatever. So I think there's an absence of nuance. If you roll back and look at Fischer in the earlier years, if you look at the book he wrote, like, it is the same Fritz Fischer, isn't it? We wrote a book about Moritz von Bethmann-Hollweg. It is the same Fritz Fischer, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is an extraordinarily subtle and nuanced study. There's no Bündnisse elite, there are no anonymous elites. It's a very sophisticated and subtle and differentiated account of a particular Protestant milieu in 19th century Prussia. And so the question that interests me is, how does the Fritz Fischer of 1937, who writes that book, become the Fritz Fischer of the post-war period, and how important in that process is a sense of contamination, which had to do with the Nazi period and Fischer's own involvement in that. He was an adult, he was 25 when the Nazis came to power, and 37 when the whole thing collapsed.
Holger Afflebach.
My question is somehow linked to Chris's question, because I was surprised to hear, especially from the report of Emanuel Geis, to what extent Fischer was relying on his underlings. To an extent that we basically can say that it was a kind of co-authored book, the way Geis is describing it. Sorry, it's not the work of a single person. It's a person. It's at least there are at least two or three people writing this book, and maybe this lack of nuance or this lack in this change in style has also something to do with the people who are cooperating. And this was also my original question, because later on Fritz Fischer became even more radical, and one of his later cooperators was Bernd Felix Schulte. Was maybe Bernd Felix Schulte one of the reasons that he went a little bit off? So this is a first question. And I have a second question to Bernd Sösemann and this edition of the Rietzler Diaries. There is this famous issue of the Blockblätter. And indeed, this is very difficult to explain why Rietzler wrote the July Crisis stuff on the Blockblätter, and then he continued in the little booklets. But if we consider that probably Rietzler himself revised the manuscript and wrote the Blockblätters himself, and nobody ever said that he didn't, then why did he leave so much highly controversial stuff in it? I quote now out of my memory this 8th of July, very famous quotation: Kommt der Krieg aus dem Osten, dann haben wir eine Chance zu gewinnen. Kommt der Krieg nicht, will der Zar nicht oder rät das bestürzte Frankreich zum Frieden, dann haben wir immer noch die Chance, über diese Aktion die Entente auseinander zu dividieren. If he revised that, and if we consider that Rietzler was in the interwar period a German nationalist, why did he let this in?
A round of answers. Who would like to answer to Chris Clark's question?
Well, I mean, I would agree with what Holger has just said, that this is a book that is, you say, co-authored. That's perhaps a polite way of putting it. There is clearly it's endemic. I would imagine it's endemic among the professoriate in the 1950s and 60s, that you depend so heavily on the archival research, but also on the writing support of your assistants. So what we're seeing here is very largely, at least for the first 500 pages of the first draft, 400, 500 pages of the first draft, not so much Fritz Fischer's prose at all. We're seeing Emanuel Geis's prose, with Fischer occasionally making oral suggestions, but also occasionally leaving the room while Geis is there to continue writing, and of course very heavily dependent on the documents which are being pushed onto the desk from time to time. It's very interesting. What is often seen as one of, to go back to methodology, one of the weaknesses, the lack of nuance in Fischer's book, is actually the very thing that I admired so much and has informed my own methodology, in that I too quote endlessly from the documents, because that's actually what persuaded me that Fischer was mainly right. It was not so much what he was saying, not so much the text in between the quotations, but what the quotations actually say themselves. So, but yes, there is a lack of nuance, of course, and there's a huge difference in style between the various books that Fischer writes, and maybe that is, as Holger suggested, down to the fact that he's changed his supporting staff in the meantime, or that there are several people at work. We don't know. We know that Helmut Böhmer largely wrote chapter one. We know that Hartmut then corrected some of the mistakes, or all the mistakes in there that he found, but maybe other people were at work as well in that first chapter.
Factory.
Yes, but I would like to defend the grand line of the book. In this sense, he had the September program,
I didn't believe in its relevance. I told this. But then comes Brest-Litovsk, and in all these peace steps in between, there is such a strong continuity that it is perhaps you forget about these subtleties, because the line was the outcome was very, very, very clear in a sense. I think this is important. Subtleties is that the Prussian bureaucracy was not so warmongered than others and so on, but he said Bethmann isn't nicht Deutschland, and I think this is a point I took very seriously, that we made a mistake. So the line is in itself a dynamic which informs the book, I think.
But it's still astonishing that he was so dependent on suggestions of his assistant and students. Yeah. And you come along, said that you should have a chapter on this, and the other one comes on and, yeah, and he says yes all the time. And so is it his line or... anyway, so the...
I just want to say a word about the relevance of the Fischer research nowadays. We didn't put the question, what this book on the origins and on the war, the July 40 chapter, for instance, is worth scientifically nowadays? And what does it mean to students? I made the experience that when I had one of my last seminars in Düsseldorf, I made on the July crisis and on Germany and the First World War. My students did not even understand Fritz Fischer nowadays. We old men, which we are now, we must realize that they are much more differentiated, that the argument that Germany was guilty in everything and that the German drive to the West and to the East had been the most important thing, they do not match. They do not understand. If they are right or left, they do not understand. The research is now so differentiated that it is really difficult to understand this drawing in one line at that moment. But I repeat, it had been necessary. So Fischer does not do any endeavor to understand what the Germans did then. He's criticizing, he's accusing. Students of our days now don't even understand. And the most difficult thing, that is, the last word. The most difficult thing is that the only edition of the July 14 crisis, these are the three volumes of Geis nowadays, and this is a scandal.
Okay. Yeah. Then, Hirschfeld first, then Stieg first. Then.
Well, let me ask the panel bluntly. Has Fritz Fischer written what he wrote as an answer to his wrongdoing in the Third Reich? Did he try to do right what he considered had been wrong? Or was there a kind of process? In a recent article, a Hamburg historian, Rainer Nicolaisen, it's called Rebell wider Willen, Fritz Fischer und die Geschichte eines nationalen Tabubruchs, argues that this was a long-term process, starting already in 1949 with his inaugural lecture. The inaugural lecture was about the failure of German Protestantism, and he, Fischer, considers this was the main fault of German history, that we heard it from John Moses, that Protestantism went utterly wrong. And Fischer, when he actually put his things, or considered to put his things for the Bundesarchiv, he collected. And in fact, in one of his papers, Nicolaisen has found, he said, the break with Gerhard Ritter did already happen in 1949 over his inaugural lecture. That was when Ritter utterly disagreed, even on the role of Protestantism, with Fritz Fischer.
If I pass it straight to that point, or?
Yes, also.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I should just preface this by saying that I wrote my PhD on the Fisher controversy and sort of on the origins or the context of the controversy. I mean, there's a chapter on Fisher's Nazi past and the sort of continuing relevance of this for his post-45 writing of history. And I think his sort of conversion goes far back than just 1949, even into the late war years. He supports Nazi ideology throughout the war. One could sort of discuss to what extent he adapts to Nazi historiography or the Nazi historical profession, and to what extent he's a true believer or to what extent he has to adapt because he wants to make a career in academia. But what you can see, there's some evidence from some late diaries from 1942 and 1943, is that Fisher in 1943 starts to call into question Nazi ideology, and sort of develops some questions that where you could make the argument that they are already the underlying questions in Griff nach der Weltmacht. He asks questions about why does this happen? Is there a continuity between Germany after the First World War and before the First World War? So this question of continuity already comes up at the end of the war. And then what Matthew Stibbe already pointed out, what is crucial to sort of make, to assert or reinforce this beginning transformation is his experience as a prisoner of war. Which is crucial because he's in Dachau where other criminals of war are kept, and he was a suspected war criminal, which it turned out he wasn't. But he's together with men who worked in the SS, and there are a number of references to this experience where he says that this completely changed his mind by living with these people who still glorified what they did as members of the SS. So I think this transformation process starts to grow in the late or at the end of the Second World War and keeps being reasserted, reaffirmed. And another point that I would make is his experience in not just in the United States but also in Britain in 1950. His diaries and a very long report of his experience in Britain, where he was for three weeks, is very interesting. He goes to the House of Commons to view a debate, and he says this is the most important experience he had in Britain because he couldn't believe that a political debate that is looking for a solution and a civilized political debate is possible. You can sort of see the experience of debates in Parliament, in the Weimar Republic Parliament, that sort of he can't quite believe that politicians actually try to find a solution to a problem. And he's absolutely astonished by this. And this is where he becomes sort of more political and democratic and sees that democracy actually works for the better. And another point which might explain the difference in nuances, sorry if I'm going on for a bit too long, or the loss of nuance in his work between 1938 and 1961, if you like, is the experience in Britain and the United States, because particularly in the United States, he's there to experience the social sciences and sort of use his engagement with the social sciences in the United States to transfer this back into the University of Hamburg for a program in political science. And what he says, what he experiences there, is that both in Britain, but even more so in the United States, you're expected to develop an argument. And he's completely astonished by this, that what is crucial to the writing of history, and even more so the writing of political science, is that you develop an argument, and that you don't necessarily have to take into account the complexity of everything, but that it's not about knowledge in its entirety, but it's about developing an argument, and that your evidence needs to support this argument. And I think this is something that we can see in Griff nach der Weltmacht, is that Fisher has a very clear argument. He's not interested in all the complexities necessarily. He wants to make an argument, which is something he had encountered in Britain and the United States. There needs to be an argument, and the evidence needs to support that argument. Thank you very much.
Sorry. Addition. And Stiegfester, and there's one more question, and then we...
Maybe just an addition to what he just said.
Use the microphone, please.
I had a chance to look at the personal papers of Fritz Fischer, exactly what Christopher Clark said and what Mr. Krumay said. He's a very interesting figure, and I just wanted to know what happened in these war years. And what you said, I would also prefer the change in his mind started and at the end of 1942 or at the beginning from 1943 with the Stalingrad disaster. He wrote papers or letters like 10, 12 pages long and just thinking about if this is right what the Wehrmacht or the leadership of Germany is doing. Before that, he was a supporter of the Nazis. He embraced his soldiership. It kind of got a crack when I had the feeling when his brother died in 1940 in the France expedition. His brother died there, and then he started to question this. And the change kind of completed when he was a prisoner of war, because exactly what you said, he was disgusted by the behavior of other SS soldiers he was imprisoned with, because they still embraced the Nazi ideology. And so I really, I would agree that the change started earlier than 1949.
Okay, any comments from your side on that, or no?
We can open another debate. That will take too long.
Lieber Herr Aflerbach, ich wollte Ihnen das eigentlich ersparen. Ich sage das mal ganz diplomatisch. Also der Editor, der seine Arbeit ernst nimmt, muss so viel Material zur Verfügung stellen, muss so transparent und offen und vielschichtig arbeiten, dass seine Leser eine Chance haben, mit dem von ihm zur Verfügung gestellten Material auch ihn zu widerlegen. Das geschieht nicht. Und wenn der Verlag mit Ihrer Hilfe eine zweite Auflage macht und der geschätzte Kollege Aflerbach schreibt, Erdmann arbeite besonders akribisch und sorgfältig, Seite 2, die Aufzeichnungen zeigten einen hohen Grad an Authentizität, Seite 13, die Kritik beanstande lediglich Glättungsvorwürfe, Seite 12, dann kann ich nur sagen, das geht voll daneben. Das tut er an anderer Stelle, aber genau da, wo es drauf ankommt, nämlich die Juli-Krise, die ja auch in der Debatte stand, da tut er es nicht. Und dann kann man auch, wenn man dieses Material transparent vorgeführt bekommt, erkennen, dass offensichtlich Rietzler selbst mit seiner Überarbeitung nicht zufrieden war. Aber das ist ein Appell, da müssen wir alle interpretieren. Denn was steht da oben links an diesem Dokument, was ich Ihnen gezeigt habe? Da steht, liegen bei Philosophica und Metaphysica und so weiter. Diese Blätter lagen gar nicht im Tagebuch. Wir wissen gar nicht, welches die Intentionen und die Zielsetzungen in welcher Situation waren. Aber wenn man, wie das jetzt in der zweiten Auflage geschieht, all das nicht tut, dann hat man auch keine Chance, sondern dann verfestigt man nur eine Fassung, die eben nicht wertvoll ist. Noch dazu, wenn in dem Text sinnentstellende Fehler drin sind, jeder von uns kann sich bei einer Transkription verlesen, aber ich verstehe nicht, dass der Verlag nicht ändert, eine Lage sei unhaltbar, schreibt Erdmann. Es steht aber im Text, das Ganze sei hinhaltbar. Das ist ein erheblicher Unterschied. Und die andere Stelle, am 1.9.1914, dies war vom 7. Juli, am 1.9.14 heißt es bei Erdmann eine unbeantwortete Frage. Eindeutig klar. Im Text steht aber eine unbeantwortbare Frage. Und also ich wollte es Ihnen eigentlich ersparen, aber so eine Ausgabe darf man einfach nicht mitverantworten, würde ich nicht moralisch argumentieren, sondern als leidenschaftlicher Editor. Das bringt die Geschichtswissenschaft nur voran, wenn wir uns alle darauf stürzen können und alle uns Gedanken machen können, was wohl da gemeint war von Rietzler.
Van Zosiman developed an argument, definitely, and we leave the footnotes, I think, to a debate over a glass of wine. And before we do that, I think I would like to thank all the panelists this evening for debating with us.